Hi guys, I am home. Oh man, it is so good to be home. Now, having said that, I did have a really, really awesome trip. That was, I think, just the perfect length. So I'd mentioned before, I was trying to do a little bit less of the flying around places. Well, actually, in fairness, it's not so much less of the flying, it's more less of the being away. So in previous years, I would have gone away for, I think last year when I did this London trip, it was 3 weeks. The year before was about 4 weeks. And I did a heap of stuff. This year, I just went bang, 2 weeks. In fact, it was 2 weeks and 2 days to the day. And frankly, that was perfect. It wasn't too hard on my family. It wasn't too long for me. It was good. So this is a better routine. I'm going to talk more about trying to have that balance when I talk about one of the things I've written this week. So that was good. What was not quite as good is that it does still take 30 hours to get home. So it was literally 30 hours after walking out of the hotel in Copenhagen to walking into my own home. I'll turn the noise off in the background there. Partly because it was a very painful Copenhagen to Dubai. And actually that bit was comfy. No problems there. But then had to go Dubai to Singapore and then Singapore to Brisbane, which is an extra leg than normal. And I think it boiled down to something like the flights to go direct were like just ridiculously more money and it just didn't make sense. So that was a bit painful, 3 7-hour flights. And the other thing is that I landed at like 1 something in the morning, which is really unusual for Australia because I thought we had curfews, but I think you can have some exceptions. So I went to bed at like 3 a.m. or something by the time I got home and then kind of calmed down a bit because I was buzzing from flying and everything. So anyway, I did get home, which was good, and I think I've pretty much sorted out the jet lag too. So it's actually worked out pretty quick this time. So 4 days in and we're all good. So moving on to things this week. Now I've written a couple of things, and now that I'm home, I can actually spend more time writing things, which is good. But something popped up the other day, which I thought I'd touch on because it created debate and some people on the internet got upset. And I know we've discussed this before, but there are people on the internet who love to get upset about just the most, like, things that should not upset them. Anyway, let me explain what it was. There was a story I saw the other day that someone pointed me to. And the title of this story is, Should Coders Have Their Own Version of the Hippocratic Oath? Now, the Hippocratic Oath is the thing that medical professionals take, and I'll read a bit here from Wikipedia just to make sure that we're all on the same wavelength in terms of what the Hippocratic Oath is. It's an oath historically taken by physicians. It's one of the most widely known of Greek medical texts. In its original form, it required a new physician to swear by a number of healing gods. True story. To uphold specific ethical standards, the oath is the earliest expression of the medical ethics in the Western world, establishing several principles for medical ethics which remain paramount significance today. And the sort of the whole principle of this is that doctors shouldn't hurt people. You know, like their objective here is to do good. Great objectives, no problems with that. Now, this story, should coders have their own version of the Hippocratic Oath? And more specific than the story itself, because it was a little bit tangential, that the title. I quote tweeted this a few days ago, and I said, if your dodgy JavaScript could directly lead to someone dying, then yes. But it doesn't, and physical harm outcomes are far enough removed from the coder that this will never happen. Now, that the core of my argument here, and I think it's something tangential that people get upset about, the core of my argument is that we're never going to see a Hippocratic Oath or a requirement for certification or anything like that for quote-unquote coders. And of course, I use the JavaScript example here. Like, can you imagine someone writing web apps saying, I've actually got to go through and take a Hippocratic Oath or go through some formal certification before I can write my cat commenting forum software or the site that allows me to order some coffee from the local coffee shop or whatever it may be. And I think the thing that upsets some people is that they felt that people building software should be held to a higher standard. Now let's be clear. No one agrees with that more than me. Trust me. I've just come back from 2 weeks of talking to people about how they should be held to a higher standard and here are the things that they can do to hopefully achieve that higher standard. But I think the thing that really upset people is that they had a perception that I didn't feel that was the case. Now, we need to be clear. What I think is that we're not going to see any sort of formalization into the software role. This is not like medicine where you need to actually be certified. This is not, you've got to do a 5-year degree and practice on cadavers because if you screw it up, someone might die. Now, some people argue that point. They said, well, there are plenty of roles where you write software, or if you screw the software up, someone may die. There are really fundamental differences, and people love to try and make comparisons. They're like, oh, this is like medicine or engineering. We'll come back to engineering. Writing software is fundamentally different. Now, I'll give you one good example. So if you're a surgeon and you're operating on someone's heart and you, as the surgeon, accidentally slit an artery, like, you are very, very directly responsible for the well-being of that person. People gave me examples where they said, well, what if you're building automotive systems and you're the person writing the software for the automotive system? Well, you know, like, let's play that out. So you're, first of all, writing software to a spec that inevitably someone else has written. There is going to be extensive QA, extensive testing, extensive peer review. You are going to be one of many, many different people writing it. And then it's going to be tested extensively in the vehicle. And there are going to be all sorts of other regulations because you're in the automotive industry as well. You're building a big tin can that drives around on the road. And you're one tiny part of the whole machine that makes the car work, which is very different to when you're the surgeon with your hand inside someone's chest. So, you know, there's that side of things. I kept thinking back to the Equifax situation. So remember, Equifax basically threw some sysadmin under the bus because they said, oh, one guy didn't patch Apache Struts. You know, like, it was due to one person's failure. And we all got so upset because we said, well, this is not how it works. This one guy is part of the machine, and there are meant to be fail-safes and fallback positions and all sorts of other things. And this is sort of precisely the point. You know, when you are writing software, you are part of a bigger machine. When we talk about software that could have a life-changing impact on people, not your cat forum. Your cat forum is one bloke in his bedroom writing something between university courses, and that's fine. We want that. We don't want to put a massive burden on the people doing that, because the people doing that sort of stuff have written many of the libraries and many of the software that we all use today to build the things that we do. So I didn't think that was a very apt comparison. Now, the engineering thing, a bunch of people said, well, you know, engineers take an oath. Now, maybe this is in some parts of the world, I don't know. And software developers are really engineers. In fact, someone in particular kept using the term like it was the same thing. And I appreciate there's lots of debate out there as to whether software developers should be called engineer or craftsman or craftwomen or journeymen, or I assume journeywomen as well, or whatever other term you want to put on it. But building software is not the same as building a freaking bridge. It is a very, very different situation. And as much as we might like to try and make these in real life kind of analogies where we say what we do online is very similar to what we do in the physical world, it's not. It's a very, very different thing. So people got kind of upset about that in ways that I think were incommensurate with the original tweet. Because the original tweet said, this will never happen. Now, if I'm proven wrong, and it does happen, and 5 years down the track, we all have a Hippocratic Oath and those just building software will take it. We'll come back and I'll say I'm wrong, but I'm not going to be wrong. It's not going to happen for all the reasons just mentioned. Now, there are a couple of people in particular that got really upset about this, you know, very vehemently upset. And I've sort of mentioned it a few times before that often you'll see behavior online which is incommensurate with the way people would behave in real life, you know, face to face. And frankly, when we get to that point where people are just getting rude and obnoxious and angry in a way that they would never do to my face. I've never had this happen, and I get around a lot. There's plenty of opportunity for people to be rude and angry to my face. Never happened. When they start going down that path, it's just mute time. You know, like I've mentioned this before, I'm starting to mute people. I don't want to say very easily, but perhaps more liberally. And the reality of it is I've got more tweets and mentions and things now than what I can ever see, than what I can ever reply to. And ultimately, if there's a proportion of that which is angry, aggressive, non-constructive, I'm just going to mute it. And they're not going to know I've muted it. And they'll be getting angry and aggressive in response to subsequent messages sometime next month because I'll tweet something else they don't like and I just won't even see it and they won't know. Am I not seeing it or am I ignoring them? There's the beauty of muting. It's not passive aggressive like blocking. The other thing that I'll add to that is that normally if I mute someone, it's not going to be because they said one thing I didn't like. It's normally a series of tweets over and over and over again. And usually it is not just due to one incident. It's like, hey, I saw you being a dick a month ago, 2 months ago, and now you're being a dick again. So that wasn't really a very positive note to start on, but it was something that just kind of, it just really rubbed me up the wrong way, seeing the aggressiveness with which people responded and the name calling. You know, like, this is not cool, guys. I tell my kids this is not cool. And if a 5 and an 8-year-old can understand it, you can bloody understand it as adults as well. All right, moving on past that. So this is part of a theme now. Something else that bugged me, and this just popped up this morning. And in fact, I'm going to draw this into something else. There was a story today about the dark web. I know, scary, right? And the story was about how much data is found on the dark web. It's available on the dark web. Your data is sold on the dark web. I think it was saying something like 15% of people in Fortune 500 companies have had their data found on the dark web. And I have increasingly become or come to the sort of conclusion over particularly the last couple of months that this dark web term is just being used to scare people. And that the thing that I think really kicked this off for me is some of you might have seen early December, there was news about 1.4 billion credentials on the dark web. You know, all of our data is there, 1.4 billion credentials, dark web, scary. And frankly, whenever I see a headline like that, I'm immediately suspicious because that is a very clickbaity sort of headline. And it's designed to instill fear in people so that they do click it and they read it because they're like, oh, this might sound scary. I better see what it is. That particular incident, the reality of it was the first place that data appeared was on Reddit, one of the world's largest websites, in there on Reddit. And we know it first appeared there because the guy that put it together literally wrote a post on Reddit, said, hey, I have put this together. Here it is. And that was on Reddit, and there was a link to a torrent to download that. There was also a link to a torrent to download about 570 gigabytes worth of individual source data breaches. So this is with everything in them, not just usernames and passwords, everything from IP addresses to birth dates to your sexual orientation, depending on the nature of the breaches in there. And it was all sitting there on Reddit. No dark web. You know, torrents, no dark web. Links to download individual breaches. I mean, this is the reality of where a huge amount of this data is. And every time I see dark web being used, it's usually by either media outlets because they want to scare people into reading the stories and then they show the ads and they get the revenue and everything else, or it's by security companies that are trying to convince you to buy their security shit. Because the more they can scare you, the more that you will want to buy their security shit to protect yourself because you're scared about the dark web. And it's just, it is just a ridiculous proposition. I've started writing a blog post. So I actually tweeted this and I said, you know, look, I'm getting frustrated sort of seeing these dark web references. Should I write like a dark web smackdown? And everyone's like, yeah, like you got to do this. So I've started writing it. And this is actually kind of fun to write. And I'm going to write about where so much of this data is found. And not only that, but how easily accessible the dark web, and a lot of this, of course, is on Tor, hidden services with marketplaces and things, just how easily accessible it is. And in fact, I've been doing a lot of talks where I mention this as well. And in fact, I will show people, look, here's a dark web marketplace. You go there with the Tor browser. It looks like Firefox. It works just like we're all used to. Not so scary, is it? So anyway, I'm going to write that up because I think that that's really interesting. And I want this to become my reference point every time someone makes some ridiculous claim about the dark web. All right, so that was all the things that I wanted to get off my chest. Now I can actually start talking about the new stuff. One of the great things about being back in Australia is we do have spectacular coffee. So that makes me very, very happy. Okay, so the new stuff. Two things I wrote this week. Both things related to Scott Helm. So many of you know Scott Helm already. Scott is the guy that I've teamed up with on Report URI. So back in November, we launched my involvement there. I've just been over in both the UK, in London with Scott, and then we went over to Norway together. We went sledding together, hilarious. Posted a great video of him screaming going down the hill. I thought it was very funny. And Scott and I have been doing a lot of work together on things. Now, this is partly because we sort of travel in the same circles, but partly because, you know, he's a guy that is just really, really in tune at a very, very deep level with things like security headers. So in particular, the content security policy stuff, TLS. He's been running a training called the World's Best TLS Training for a couple of years now. And basically anything else related to web security, he's very, very plugged in on. And he's sort of had this meteoric growth. So I met him a couple of years ago for the first time when I was on that four-week UK trip. And at the time, he was, you know, like he was doing a lot of good stuff, but he said, oh, he's a bit nervous about, you know, talking and being out there in public and everything. And I think it was by the end of that year, he's on the BBC the whole time. He's traveling the world doing all these events and just absolutely smashing it. And we're at Oslo, and I was doing my training. I did my Hack Yourself First workshop. He did his TLS workshop. He knocked that out of the park. He got 10 out of 10 for every single metric from every single person in the course. Just did a fantastic job. And at the same time as he was doing that, I was saying, you know, it's fun being away, but I miss my family. It's a long way. You know, I'm glad this trip's a little bit shorter. And we were having this chat while drinking beer. And when you drink beer, amazing things happen. I remember most of them, but we end up having these fantastic ideas. The whole Report URI thing, me joining him, was over beers as well. Also in Oslo, strangely enough. So we're in Oslo drinking these beers. And I'm going, man, like you're doing a fantastic job. You're getting awesome feedback. Would you like to run my Hack Yourself First workshop? And he has sat in my Hack Yourself First workshop on multiple occasions in the past. So he was there in Oslo in June at NDC. He was there in the London one for a bit as well. And he's seen the way I run these events and the way that I interact with the audience, and he knows the content inside and out. And we sort of said, look, it would be great if he could run that, because there's way more demand than what I have time for. It's on the other side of the world, which is where he is. So he's based in Manchester, which basically means that everything is close to him. You know, I know for him it feels like a long way, but trust me, it's close. So he can go all over the UK and over most of Europe very, very easily. So we sort of had this discussion about him starting to run those workshops, and it'd still be all the same content that I present, all the same slide decks, all the same lessons. Inevitably, he'll have his own anecdotes and own experiences and things that he brings to it. But he would actually run many of those in Europe, including the UK, which I think is still Europe. I'm not sure if it will always still be Europe. But anyway, that part of the world. So that's what we're doing. So what this is going to do is it's going to mean that we can deliver the same content to a lot more people, and I'll still liaise with everyone. So people still get in touch with me and say, hey, we want to do workshops. And I'll go, awesome, we've got Scott available here and there. He'll be able to deliver that in public events as well. So we'll be able to announce the first one of those pretty soon, I think. So if you're an individual who just wants to go and do training, there's an upcoming event in the UK where you can go along and do that, and you just pay for yourself. And of course, there's still all the private workshops where he can go into your company just the same way as I've been doing and do those workshops as well. So we're really stoked about that. I've had heaps of inquiries since I wrote that, and I would love to send Scott over to see your company if that's something that you're interested in. And in fairness, I will still be doing these. This is not sort of the end of it, but I'm going to try and focus more on the Aussie ones, which I've been doing more of, because obviously that's convenient for me. And I will try and do a small handful in June in Europe, because I'll be back there for NDC anyway. So if you'd really like to see me, I'm going to have a little bit of a window in June, and I'll probably try and focus on the mainland Europe stuff and leave the UK stuff to Scott. So we're really excited about that. I think it's going to be super awesome. And yeah, we'll sort of tweet and let you know how that goes as it rolls out. So that was that one. Now the next one. I have finally got a content security policy on my blog, and I wrote about this only last night. And I want to explain why it's taken so long and then what we've actually done. Now, just sort of scrolling back a little bit, remember a content security policy, a CSP, is a policy that you can use to declare what can be loaded into your site from different places. So I've had one on Have I Been Pwned for ages, and what it does on Have I Been Pwned is it says, okay, so here's a response header with the page. When the browser sees this response header, the browser is told you can load JavaScript from the same host name, so from Have I Been Pwned. You can load JavaScript from the Cloudflare CDN because I'm using things like jQuery hosted from them. You can load style sheets from Cloudflare CDN because I'm using Bootstrap. What's another good example? You can post forms to PayPal because the donate feature does that. Like you click on donate and it makes a form post to PayPal. So form action is a directive within CSP. Now, all of this stuff is to help protect you against attacks which take advantage of pulling things in from other places or trying to, in that last example, post things off to other places. So that sort of canonical attack that CSPs prevent or help prevent is XSS. So an attacker comes along, they want to mount an XSS attack, they might try and embed a script on your page. CSP can block that. Some of the other things that have been happening recently, which CSPs can also block, and I've got to write about these because they're actually kind of cool, is we're seeing a lot of CoinHive-style cryptocurrency miners inserted onto compromised sites. So someone will find a flaw, say, in the CMS of a website. They'll put a coin miner in there. Anyone who goes to the website has their CPU cycles go nuts, and a tiny, tiny fraction of whatever coin, I think there are many of them use Monero coin, goes off to the attacker. Now, this relies on being able to run the attacker's script on the victim's website. And CSP is precisely the sort of thing that can block that. So there's lots of really, really cool use cases for a content security policy. Now, normally the CSP is embedded by a response header. So you literally have a response header called content-security-policy. And then you declare all your stuff in that header and it applies to the site. As part of the CSP, you can set the report URI directive, which says if the CSP is violated, send a report to this URI. And we hope that the URI you choose to send it to is report URI the service. That's exactly what our service does. So this is the cool thing. Like you can block all this stuff, and then you can say, when it goes wrong, send me a report, and then I can see when someone's trying to attack my site. Super cool. Now, my blog runs on Ghost Pro. Now, Ghost Pro is a managed hosting platform. It's effectively SaaS. It's a software as a service product where I can upload a template, which is HTML, and that's about it. I can't add response headers. Now, because I can't add response headers, I haven't added a CSP until now. Incidentally, it would be great to be able to add it at the edge. For those of you who listen to the podcast, that was air quotes, at the edge. I.e. Cloudflare. So I run both Have I Been Pwned and my blog behind Cloudflare. They sit in the middle of the traffic, 119 edge nodes around the world. They can add content to responses. They can't add custom headers though. This is the thing. They can add something like an HSTS response header, and there's literally a GUI where you click the little button and you configure HSTS and just adds it all. They can't add custom headers, and they don't have any native construct for CSP. Now, there are Cloudflare workers which are in beta at the moment, which allows you to run code on the edge. But at the moment, they're in beta. They're not live. Also not sure what the cost of them will be yet either. So that's really not viable at the moment. Now, you can add a content security policy via a meta tag. And in fact, I've had a very, very basic one on troyhunt.com for some time now. And all it did was said upgrade insecure requests. And the reason I had that there is because at one time, this must have been more than a year ago now, Discuss, the commenting engine, started accidentally embedding a piece of content over HTTP. And as soon as they did that, I started getting a warning up in the address bar, which didn't look very good on the security side. So the upgrade insecure requests content security policy forces Chrome, Firefox, and Safari browsers, we won't go into the one that doesn't work, forces it to have any single request anywhere down the chain of requests on that page upgraded to be HTTPS, even if requested over HTTP. That is in my mind, probably the most awesome content security policy you can possibly use because it doesn't break anything. It's just absolutely seamless, which is beautiful. And, oh, I've got messages popping up there. That's gone. So that's really awesome. Upgrading secure requests. Now, I could have added an entire content security policy to the meta tag, but the problem is that you can't use the report URI directive in the meta tag. Now, this is very frustrating because once you actually build a CSP, trust me, you want a report. And I'm not just saying this because we run that report URI service. You can report to your own endpoint if you like. I mean, we'd like you to use report URI, but you have to report somewhere because you will eventually screw up your CSP. And even if you don't screw it up, you do want to see what's happening if someone does manage to inject content into your site. That's the kind of stuff you want to know. So you don't want a CSP without being able to report. You can't report in a meta tag, so what are we going to do? What we have done is Scott has written up a piece of JavaScript. He gets full credit for this, which we're calling reportURI.js. And what this does is it registers an event handler which can look for when the browser raises a content security policy violation. It then gets that violation, makes an XML HTTP request over to a report URI endpoint of your choosing. So by using a bit of JavaScript and catching that event, we can now send that off, which is awesome because it means now I can have a content security policy on my blog and actually report when it gets violated. So this is what I've done. And there's sort of two parts to this story. One is the mechanics of how it works, and the other is the sort of process I went through in order to do this. So the mechanics boils down to you add a little bit of JSON to the page, which declares some variables around things like what is the endpoint you want to report to. So you do that. You add your CSP in a meta tag, and then you include the report URI.js. And incidentally, the report URI.js is served off a CDN that's based on Cloudflare, very, very heavily cached. The sample script that we've got also uses SRI, sub-resource integrity, which validates that that script is precisely the script that you expect it to be. So if you're worried about loading script off a CDN because we might try and screw with you by changing it, we can't do that if you use SRI. And if you're really paranoid, just download the script and run it off your own site. I don't really care. So the mechanics of actually implementing it is pretty easy. The thing that I found kind of interesting is how do I take this blog, which I've been writing for almost 9 years now, I don't know how many posts are on there, I know it's lots of hundreds, how do I take that and put a content security policy on it without totally screwing it up? So I went through a bit of a process. What I did first of all, and this is all in the blog post, is I went and got the CSP Rule Collector Fiddler add-on. So Fiddler is an HTTP proxy. Many of you listening to this will use Fiddler in your daily work. That means that I can route on my local machine, I can route my browser through the local proxy. It can look at traffic and do things. What the Rule Collector does is when you browse to a website, it adds an empty content security policy, which effectively says nothing from anywhere can load, and it adds it in report-only mode, which means that actually anything from anywhere can load, but every single thing is going to send a report. And it sends a report back to Fiddler, and then the Fiddler CSP Rule Collector add-on catches those reports, and it says, based on the pages that you're viewing and the violations that have been raised by your browser, here is your CSP. And this is awesome. I think this is such an awesome tool, and it's just one DLL you download, drop it into the Fiddler scripts folder, and you're good to go. So I went and ran that, and that gave me like a baseline CSP. And it's stuff like, there's Google Analytics, and that loads scripts from here and images from here. There is my little sponsor message that comes up. That actually makes an async HTTP call off to a subdomain of troyhunt.com. So I need to have that as a connect source. There are things like I have the little subscribe thing down the bottom of my blog so you can get the newsletter that has recapture. That needs to load assets off Google. So when I ran the Rule Collector, it kind of built all of this up, and I had a really good start. And then I said, okay, that's cool. I also need to be able to load scripts off the report URI CDN, and I also need to be able to make XML HTTP requests, so a connect source, to my report URI reporting endpoint. And that's just troyhunt.report-uri.com. And I set that up. So I built what I thought was the right CSP. Then I went back to Fiddler. I turned off the rule collector, and using Fiddler's script, I added a custom response header so that every time I loaded a page from my website, it inserted at the proxy level my CSP. And it inserted it in a response header. So I know ultimately I put it in a meta tag, but it doesn't matter. It's the same policy. I put it in the response header and I browsed around my site and I just kept watching the console. So what I was effectively able to do is say, let me get my CSP into the site without other people seeing it because it's just injected by my local proxy. So as I browsed around, I literally took the console, snapped it off onto another screen. I've got four nice monitors around here. Browsed around, waited until stuff broke. And when stuff broke, I updated the policy. And I spent probably a few hours doing that. And I thought, okay, well, what are the sorts of things I've got to look at? I've got to look at blog posts where I have embedded tweets, for example. Because whenever you embed a tweet, it requests a whole bunch of stuff off Twitter. Different domains, different content types, scripts, images, CSS. So I did that, kept tweaking it. I went and loaded a few other pages with different things. Things like my weekly videos are YouTube videos. So I made sure that I had all those things in there. And I got the policy to the point where all of my recent blog posts and all of the main stuff, like the links across the top, etc., everything loaded without error. And I pushed that out. So it made the policy effective. Now, this means that everyone is now getting the CSP on every page. I knew that I would break some stuff. In the original blog post, I went, look, there's a lot of years, a lot of blog posts. I have broken stuff. Because I'm reporting, I can see what I've broken. Because people's browsers are literally saying, hey, I tried to load this thing, but your policy didn't allow it. Send me a report, let me know. So I got up this morning and I went through my reports and inevitably I found a few things. And what I found was a combination of different browsers implementing things a little bit differently. And incidentally, that could simply be because some external services return different content types or different resources to different browsers. And I found some pages, particularly older pages on my site, which were trying to request things that I hadn't considered. So that the first bit, I was finding things like, I think one of them was for some reason, people on Safari were making connect source requests, so XML HTTP style requests, to Google Analytics. And it only came up against Safari. So in the report URI interface, I could actually see that there were like 20 users all on Safari that were doing this, not on the other browsers. So I don't know why. That's something that Google has done that only impacts Safari users. So it's like, okay, well, you know, 20 people on Safari didn't get tracked. I'm sure they're very upset about that. I'm going to now add that in my CSP. I also found that I was getting reports from my Ubiquiti blog post. So this was the Ubiquiti networking gear because I had embedded a gist in the page and I hadn't whitelisted gist. So this then led me to the point of saying, okay, well, what do I do? If I want to embed content off gist, I have to go through and whitelist this stuff. Otherwise, I have to not embed content off gist. And then I thought, well, gist is the sort of thing that I have embedded on a number of blog posts. It's the sort of thing I'm probably going to want to embed in the future. So I whitelisted it. So gist is now in there. I found that there was a really old blog post about the only secure password is the one you can't remember. And this was an epic blog post. This is one of these ones which has just been shared over and over and over again over many, many, many years. I think it was about 6 years ago I wrote that. And I had a YouTube video embedded in there. And the way that YouTube used to do embedded videos back then was they still had a lot of dependency on Flash and you'd use an object tag. Now that still works so long as your CSP doesn't block it. Now I was not allowing objects. I don't want to allow objects. So I went back, edited that blog post and put in a normal iframe embed, which is the way videos such as this one get embedded on a page now. And that fixed it. Job done, everything okay. And what I've sort of been doing is going through going, okay, let's just find the most common incidents or the most common sorts of content types that have been blocked. Let's fix those. So most of the things are fixed for most of the people. I'll give it like an hour to run. And then I'll go back and I'll reload my report and I'll see what's there now. And what we're left with is really sort of edge case stuff. You know, old blog posts embedding things in ways they wouldn't do now. And in each one of those cases, I go, do I want to whitelist the thing that it's embedding, or do I want to upgrade the way that it's embedding to the way I would do now? So for example, I'm sure there are places where I have embedded images directly off someone else's site. It's not such a great idea because they might delete that image in the future. So I would probably in that case go, okay, look, let's actually put that image on the same site and an image source of self is already allowed in the CSP. So that would then work. So that's basically what I've been doing, just sort of going through, refining, massaging that, and getting it to the point where I think as of now, it's pretty solid. When I finish this video, I'll go and check it again, clean up a few things. And it might be some period of time where I keep finding little nuances that I need to clean up, but nothing major. So I'm actually really happy that I got the CSP on there because it's a little bit of these, one of these sort of, you know, that the plumber having leaky pipes kind of thing. Like if I'm going to be the security guy, I've got to have the security things on my assets. And whilst I had very good reasons for not having it, namely that I didn't have a way of reporting, I think now that we have this is really cool. If you want to have a CSP on your site, definitely check that out. I still think the best mechanism is to put it in the response header for many, many different reasons. But if not, this is an awesome way to go about it. And I reckon that approach of using the CSP rule collector to build it up, injecting it via your own proxy, going through your entire site, making it as sure it's as good as you can be, and then carefully monitoring your reports, I'm really happy with that process. I've got a bunch of other things I want to write about CSPs too, because one of the things you find once you have one on your site is you learn a lot of really cool stuff. So I'm going to write some follow-up stuff later on. But look, go and check that blog post out because I'm pretty stoked with the way that worked. Okay, so last thing is today, or rather this whole week, I've had DigiCert sponsoring my blog. And they've got a link through to some stuff that they've written around about the way we do mutual authentication using PKI infrastructure with IoT devices. So there is a really good place for certs in models like that as well. You know, certs are not just something that we use to get padlocks on browsers. So that's pretty cool. I really appreciate those guys sponsoring me. And it's funny, as soon as I said PKI, I had a funny experience when I did that congressional testimony a couple of months ago, where the guy sitting next to me, the other expert, he said something in his testimony where he used the term PKI. And one of the congressmen said, you know, you use this word. Can you please explain to me what PKI is? And I was going, oh, dude, man, I'm just glad it's not me. And I'm sort of shuffling my chair away from him going, you're on your own here, buddy. Because this is not an easy thing to explain to people in layman's terms. But look, he did an admirable job under duress. Anyway, so that's DigiCert. They're up there this week, and there'll be someone new again next week. So look, that's it for now. Incidentally, you may notice things look a little bit darker than usual. It's actually kind of a crap day out here, and I just thought I'd add that because I know I send a lot of photos about the weather and how awesome it is. If you had been watching my tweet timeline on Wednesday, it was freaking epic. Today, not so much. So for those of you in colder places where it might be raining a little bit, you can take solace in the fact that the temperature has gotten down to 21 degrees. And that literally means I've had to wear a jumper here. This is not a joke. So see, it's kind of miserable in our own way sometimes here as well. On that note, I'm going to leave you. Thank you very much for watching. And I'll come from you from home again next week. See you guys.